Welcome to the Dork Forest. Jackie and her pals will never bore us. Shameless confessions
about our obsessions
will make us laugh and smile. So let's explore the Dork Forest and dork out for a while.
Hi, it's Jackie Cation. Welcome to the Dork Forest. You know the websites, JackieCation.com, DorkForest.com, TheDorkForest.com, FamilyPetAncestry.com. I bought a lot of domain names, you guys. And then allthingscomedy.com/JackieCation, all lowercase, is where this will make an excellent Horcrux, my new comedy special, where you can get a $5 download of that. Anyway, let's do the credits. Mike Rickberg composed and sang the song you just heard, and he'll do his version of the Mexican Hat Dance at the end of the program. He is a great musician, and if you ever get a chance to see him play live, you should do that. Patrick Brady's going to fix this audio. Vilmos does my website, JackieCation.com, where you can buy t-shirts, you can get hooded sweatshirts, you can get a CD or a DVD, hard copies of everything that's available on iTunes and Amazon. And you can always email me, by the way, if you ever need to email me about anything, Jackie@JackieCation.com. You want to tell me about how much you're loving the show. You can review the show on iTunes. You can, I don't know, you can buy a sandwich. I don't know what you can do. You can do whatever you want. But other than that, stand-up comedy. I do stand-up comedy. This week I'm actually home in Los Angeles. So check my Twitter feed at Jackie Cation. And you'll find out where I'm doing stand-up comedy this week. And then you'll know things. But let's get into it, because it's a fascinating episode. This one's a good one, you guys. Hey, it's Jackie Cation. I am sitting in my living room with Brian Upton. Brian Upton, you've been on the show before, but mostly remotely.
The last time I was on your show, oh, God, it was like... It was much more primitive. You didn't have these nice microphones then. I think we were all like talking into phones or something.
Yeah, I think it was you, Scott. It was Scott Rogers and Andy.
It was about game design. Yeah,
and it was all about game design in general. And nobody really got to talk because all three of you know too much, and you were all like, and it's only an hour. So I've been trying to have you on just to talk for yourself. Like I had Scott on. And then he chose to talk about Disneyland. And then and Andy's on whatever. I'm surprised he's not here today, quite honestly. He died. Whenever the game design comes up, he's like, well, you know, I could probably come on and have some good questions. And I'm like, yes, you are welcome at any time. But he went to fill my car up with gas, and that makes him an excellent human being.
So he's a production assistant
He's more PA guy. Yeah, that's it. So, okay, so Brian Upton, you are on Twitter, at BB Upton. B as in Brian, B as in Blair. You as an Upton, Brian, BB Upton. And then you have a new book out, which is what has inspired us to finally gather. And it's about game design. And it is called The Aesthetic of Play.
Yes.
So that is a tree in the forest that we are going to go and find. And I'm going to need a compass and I'm going to need a water bottle. So do you have a website?
No, actually, the book has a website. It's from MIT Press.
Okay.
And so if you go to MIT Press and search for either me, Brian Upton, or The Aesthetic of Play, you can find it there.
It'll all come together.
Yeah.
That'll be perfect. And we are going to talk about The Aesthetic of Play, but at lunch, which we just had, you were telling me that you read last year an amazing book about the history of D&D or why it started or how the – What happened?
It was so gloriously geeky in a way that I really love because it also tied in with my own memories of Dungeons & Dragons. Because I started playing in the 70s when it was really kind of marginal and all the artwork.
Super new, right?
Yeah, it was brand new and all the artwork was very, very like roll your own, kind of barely able to draw. And it was kind of hinky in a variety of ways. And I really loved that about early D&D. And so the book I was reading, it's by a guy named John Peterson. Yeah. And it's called Playing at the World.
Okay.
And it's this encyclopedic history of the invention of D&D. It's like 600 pages leading up to the release of Dungeons & Dragons. And basically, he goes back and he traces all these weird subculture threads that fed into what eventually became D&D.
So it's not like a history of Gary Gygax. It's a history of what leads to Gary Gygax?
Yeah, I mean, Gary Gygax is in it, obviously.
Sure.
But the actual like development of the rules is kind of like a little coda at the end. What it's really about is all the different influences. So he goes back and looks at... how wargaming was invented is a way to train soldiers in Germany. And then
tabletop
wargaming. And then he goes through H.G. Wells had his own tabletop wargaming system called Tiny Wars, which he was like super. He would crawl around and play with toy soldiers on the floor and shoot cannons, and he had rules for them.
And he was 35 years old.
Oh, yeah, he was a grown man doing all this.
And nobody, and nobody gave him, well, I'm sure somebody gave him some shit. But
yeah, but you can't give H.G. Wells shit.
Yeah, you can't give H.G. Wells shit. He's above it. He's above your judgment.
Yeah, and so there's all these interesting like trickles of things that eventually fed into what became wargaming as a hobby in the 20th century. There are these sort of weird precursors where things didn't quite get started. The designer, Norman Bel Geddes, who is famous for a lot of sort of Art Deco sort of stuff, was apparently really into his own homegrown gaming system that he played with his little circle of intellectual friends in his New York apartment.
Whoa, wait a minute. So Bel Geddes himself is like an interior designer, an architect?
Or? Yeah, just a general designer. I mean, he designed furniture, he designed buildings, he designed aircraft. He's an industrial designer.
Okay.
And it's sort of very famous for creating that sort of distinctive Art Deco look. I mean, he was really innovative at a time when that mattered.
Oh, fair enough. Right. Yeah.
But he also was fascinated with simulation. And so he built an entire landscape out of cork that he kept in his New York apartment. And he had this super elaborate war game that was played with thousands of push pins as the markers. And he would have his smart set of New York intellectuals over, and they'd all crawl around on the floor and move push pins. And fight little wars.
What year is this?
This is 1920s or 30s. Yeah.
So like Algonquin Roundtable times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But with gaming.
But with gaming, which having the same witty conversations that we all do about lycanthropes.
Yeah.
And it was a war game system kind of?
Yeah, but the interesting thing is the system's completely lost. We know that it involved cork boards and push pins.
Okay.
But what's interesting about this book is that it shows all these things that were gestures towards what became wargaming, but never quite went anywhere. So nobody built on Tiny Wars, for example. It flared up and then went away. Nobody built on Bel Geddes' system. And there are other things like that. And it wasn't until the 1950s.
Out or something.
Yeah. In the 1950s, it really started turning into a real hobby. And it was that hobby that later led to the environment that allowed for D&D to be created.
Okay. So, I mean, because I would think, like, because back in Roman days, right, they would fill the Colosseum and have fake naval battles, right?
Yeah. Naumachia.
Is that what it was called?
That's called.
Nice work. And but that is like, I mean, they were not to scale. They were small. They were scaled. They weren't to scale. So they were small boats fighting. And so what that had to lead event, I mean, because like all gaming systems went forward. And that was, and then I remember someone like, I remember reading some fiction novel written in the 1800s where people were recreating like Napoleonic battles.
That was probably the Kriegsspiel. And that was a German invention.
Okay.
And it's really interesting because
how do you spell Kriegsspiel? And it's an awesome German word.
Kriegsspiel.
Good guess. I like it.
And which is literally just war game.
Okay.
But that time there's only one, so they could call it the Kriegsspiel. it started off, gaming kind of went away as this, people didn't think about gaming as simulation up through the classical period and the Renaissance. They didn't think about they were actually doing something that mapped onto the real world.
Okay.
And the one of the big innovations of the Kriegsspiel was that it was actually treated as a model for how things would unfold in the real world. The guy who invented it was a German count, and he invented it as a way to train German soldiers. And so it wasn't intended to be a fun thing to play. I mean, obviously,
war simulations before they became electronic or whatever.
Yeah.
They were the first.
And this was a big deal that you could actually simulate, because previously, I mean, people's idea was like, oh, you get a bunch of guys together and they're all tough and you go out and beat people up.
Right, right. You could practice sword fighting, you could practice shooting, but you can't practice, and you could practice marching, I suppose.
Right, but you couldn't practice strategy. The idea that you could actually like play out something on a board and then that would apply to something in the real world. That was revolutionary.
Right.
It was a huge deal for the Germans when they invented this. I mean, once the French and the English found out that they were doing this, like, oh, we have to have one of these as well. And so
it was like a,
yeah,
like, what is that called? When a nuclear proliferation, the war, the escalating.
Oh,
what's the
mutual
word?
Assured destruction.
Sure. I don't care. It's the words I'm thinking, but it's because previously there was only chess, right?
Right. And chess is, it teaches you some things,
right?
But you know, like
But it's not.
Horsemen can run to either side. I don't know.
Right. There are different. There's different ranged attacks and different this type of things. And there is in chess. But I can see how this Kriegspiel. Kriegspiel would be just at a more minutia level and more realistic level using.
It wasn't designed to be fun. I mean, the idea was that you'd have a referee and you'd be very serious about it because you were really trying to learn. It was intended as a teaching tool, but I mean, everybody then figured out like, wow, this is really fun.
Yeah, I want to play that again.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, it's like airplane simulations where you're like, no, you're supposed to be learning how to fly the plane, and you're like, yes, but it's really fun to also fly the pretend plane.
Right.
So,
exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And so gradually it became, the fun aspect became more prominent. But there's this interesting split, which Peterson goes into in the book, about the distinction between gamism and simulationism. And gamism, there's things you do in a game design that make it fun to play.
Right.
And fun to play doesn't necessarily make it realistic. And so there's always this tension between, like, are we accurately simulating what's going on? Is this teaching us something about the real world? Or are we just doing this because it's entertaining? And this is present in modern role-playing. Well, yeah, in games as well. I mean,
yeah.
One of the first video games that I worked on was the original Rainbow Six. And there was a tension we faced all the time.
I don't know that game.
Oh, you didn't know they worked on Rainbow Six?
I never, yeah. What system?
This was on PC.
Oh, it was a PC game.
It was a PC game. Well, and then it got ported to, like, everything. And it's,
okay.
And it's still around now, but it was the original one that I designed, and there's this really interesting tension because we wanted it to be fun. I mean, we wanted people to buy it, but it was a Tom Clancy branded game, and Tom Clancy's brand is all about, oh, you're getting like the inside information. This is how it really is. And so we would have all these arguments over like, well, can we make people move a little faster? How fast can we make them realistically run? How many gunshots could someone realistically take? Because if you make it really realistic, I mean, real war is kind of scary and boring. And
there's a lot of sitting around time.
There's a lot of sitting around. There's a lot of like things that happen really fast. You never figure out why something happened. I mean, it's, right. There's a lot of chaos that's not fun. I mean, it's not like, war is not designed to be a fun experience. And so trying to figure out where you walk the line between simulation and game.
Brian, can I please have a t-shirt that says war is not designed to be a fun experience? I'm sorry, but because those Tom Clancy books, people read them and go, well, that's what it's really like, the Illuminati, man.
Yeah.
And they wanted that in the game.
Yeah. What we realized is that people wanted the feeling of that in the game. Cause if we made it really real, then, it felt unreal because it was so like, boring that people are like, oh, well, it's gotta be more exciting than this. And so we tried to create the illusion of reality.
Yeah, right.
It's like,
okay.
if you can fake sincerity, you've got it made. I mean, we were like, how can we make it so that people believe they're getting what it's really like when they're actually not?
Right, because they wouldn't want it because they wouldn't buy it and they wouldn't play it if it were what it were really like.
Exactly.
Yeah, that would be the math class of they're not dreams.
Yeah, I mean, there are some people who would like that. Part of what's interesting when you look at this is that people have different tastes, and some people really like really hardcore simulations.
Right.
But that's a really tiny, dorky niche.
This is a very niche group where it's interesting when video games were created any game. I mean, they kind of start out with the nerds playing them.
Right.
And then the rest of the world goes, well, I kind of want it, but you're going to have to dumb it down for me.
Yeah.
Or you're going to have to do something. Not dumb. You have to make it more fun for me to make it possible. Like here, like Champions.
Mm-hmm.
There's too much math. I don't want to play. I don't want to play, even though the excitement of rolling 37 dice is something I do want to do. So if everyone wants to do the math around me and then I'm allowed to roll 37 dice, I win.
Yeah. One of the things that's charming about early Dungeons and Dragons is the fact that it was made by people who were really into simulation.
Okay.
And so you have all these strange vestigial bits of simulation that are stuck in there, like, here are rules for 20 different types of pole arms. So I know the difference between a glaive and a glaive guisarme and a bardiche and a halberd, and we're going to have different rules for each one of these.
Because of their range or because of how tall they are?
Well, because they were all this grew out of people doing medieval simulation. And so if you're trying to recreate the Battle of Agincourt, well, it kind of matters what pole arms people have.
Right.
And so actually, I don't think there would be pole arms at Agincourt. No, it was more knights versus, I'm exaggerating here.
Okay.
Because I know people will call me on this. No, it was more longbowmen versus mounted knights and lances. But all of this makes a difference.
Yourself.
Yes, all of these things make a difference. If you're really into like let's recreate medieval warfare, the minutia of armor and weaponry makes a difference.
And that started in the 50s, according to the study of this sort of thing. People were like
popular wargaming really got started. It was really the board game manufacturer Avalon Hill that got it. That made it mass market.
When did that?
They released a game called Tactics, and I want to say it was like 52 or 53. I probably have that wrong.
But close?
Yeah. And then you had miniature wargaming that had kind of been trickling along. Well, people would buy toy soldiers and create rules for playing the toy soldiers. And that had been going on for 50 years at that point, but it was very, very small.
Right.
And then Avalon Hill came along and said, hey, we can – they started using hex maps.
Okay.
And they started actually –
Why hex maps? Is there a geometric reason to simulate terrain or something?
Well, okay. So the first impulse is to use squares. But the problem you realize if you use squares is that you want to move diagonally.
Mm-hmm.
And moving diagonally causes numerical problems. Because it's like if you move in a straight line along a rank, you move one space at a time. But if you move diagonally, if you're moving it, the distance you move is like the square root.
Yeah.
And so you wind up with weird movement rules if you try to move on a square grid. Whereas if you move on a hex grid, any direction you move, you're always moving the same distance. So the movement rules become really simple.
I get it.
That's why they went to the hex grids from the very beginning.
That simplifies it enormously. Okay, I get that.
Yeah. So the Avalon Hill through the 50s and 60s was ground zero for innovative wargaming, because all of a sudden the things you didn't have to have like this full set of toy soldiers, and you didn't have to embarrass yourself by crawling around on the floor playing with toy soldiers. You could have you could set up something on the kitchen table. You could have cardboard counters. You could have this sort of technical simulation sort of experience, but it wasn't something that required as much equipment.
Right. And you didn't have to be a 7-year-old or 9-year-old boy crawling around on the floor.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, people did that anyway. I mean, it's not like hardcore war gamers have, the sort of self-respect.
Right. Warhammer guys are still, care.
No, yeah. I mean, it's like if you want it, you're going to do it. You're basically like, oh, well, I don't want anybody to see me doing this. Cause it's when you
got
a really good miniature game is amazingly fun.
Yeah.
So
that's cool. Because I like all the toy value of it is really amazing.
Yeah.
Just because of how cool everything looks all set up and stuff.
Yeah.
So, and then knocking it down. So that was the 50s, and then.
Well, so this continued to evolve through the 60s, and there was board wargaming became a hobby that you could have. It was no longer isolated players. People started identifying themselves as wargamers. It's like, this is a thing I do. And that created sort of a critical mass where you had a community. You had people people started zines.
Right.
They were exchanging, they were play-by-mail games where people, it's like, oh, I'm all by myself in some little town in the Midwest and nobody else will play with me. Well, I can do play-by-email. Play-by-mail. And,
which was a real thing for wrestling and everything. I had a wrestling dork on who talked about how when they were a kid, they created a character, their wrestler, and it was in the back of a comic book. And it was, do you want to create a character and wrestle another character that someone else makes in Indiana or New Jersey? And so you would send $1 or $2 with your character, and then somebody they would send you the results of your fight. Is that like that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, people would they'd mail off turns. Like, okay, here's a list of all the places my units are going in the next turn.
Oh, okay.
And there's also this fascinating history of how do you roll dice when you're playing by mail to make sure it's fair.
Yeah.
And so there were all these systems. Like you would, people would use stock reporting. It's a little like playing the numbers. So you could say like, oh, you're going to pick whatever number you roll is going to be picked off of this column of stock quotes on this day.
I remember. I didn't know what the hell they were doing. when I was a kid, someone was like, well, I have to go look at the financial page to find out what, and I don't know.
Yeah, that was illegal gambling.
That might have been illegal.
unless you were in a very narrow niche of.
That does sound a little Elliot Cation for the world. But there was something where you were looking for numbers and it was like a lottery kind of thing.
Yeah.
Is that illegal gambling?
So the numbers game. If you've heard of the numbers game, the numbers game is a variety of illegal gambling where it's like you're betting on you're betting on public numbers, and so you're betting on like the final digit of the New York Stock Exchange.
Okay.
And so,
which has to be random. You can't guess it.
It's mostly random. You always pick the final digit because that fluctuates the most. And there's other things you can pick. Summed sports scores. You can pick the prices of different stocks. There's a variety of ways, but basically the idea is you have public random numbers that you can grab.
And so they use that for the gaming systems?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it had this weird, so this is also really cool. And this is one of the details that I love about how this influenced the design of these games. So if you start to design play by email systems, then you want to use randomization tables that are based on the numbers 1 through 10 or 0 through 9 because those are the numbers you're going to get. But it's hard to generate numbers from 0 through 9 using normal six-sided dice.
Oh, right.
So there was this desire in the 1960s for the creation of dice that would allow you to roll the number from 0 to 9 easily because that would allow you to use these systems that had been designed for play by email to play as tabletop games.
Got it.
And it was this desire that drove the importation of 20-sided dice, which eventually became the D20s of Dungeons & Dragons. The initial reason why gamers tended to have D20s laying around was so that they could play systems that had been designed for correspondence play.
Right,
at the tabletop.
So play by mail inspired people to import D20s.
Yeah.
Who invented a D20? I wonder who invented
Why they were invented is unclear. There was a company in Japan that for some reason was making D20s. And so this one guy, I think on the West Coast, I don't remember the details.
Yeah.
Basically he's like, I'm going to order a bunch of these from Japan. If anybody wants one, write me and I'll sell you a pair. And so, it was really hard in the 60s to get dice to do this sort of thing.
Didn't they find a couple of D10s or D8s on Pompeii or something?
Oh, they found Roman D20s. Nobody knows what they played with them. But,
right. How crazy is that? That's, all right. I'm very excited about that.
Yeah. So the polygonal dice that eventually became sort of indicative of Dungeons and Dragons wound up existing within the gaming community originally to deal with problems of correspondence play.
Okay.
And the fact that you had to have these randomization systems that were not dice-based.
Wow. How old is Gary Gygax now? Because Gary Gygax is the guy who published
anymore.
It. No, he's dead now. But how old is he in the 50s and
60s? Oh, he's like a guy in his 20s.
Okay.
He's a young guy. Yeah.
Okay, so he was probably born in the 20s or 30s.
I don't know when he was born.
Right, me neither. But it turns out that the internet is out there and we can all look.
We can look
including
it up.
You, Rangers.
Yeah.
Right now, because you're probably sitting by a computer.
Yeah.
I'm not.
But it was mostly young guys.
Yeah.
Didn't you say
that there was a picture of a bunch of women?
Well, so what's interesting is in some of these things that didn't turn into mainstream war gaming, you had people who would invent war games on their own. And there was one, I can't remember the name of the guy who did it. He had his entire naval combat system. And it was, again, something that was played with his circle of friends. And there are these wonderful drawings of these women in these very smart 1940s dresses down on their hands and knees, like shooting battleships at each other.
That's awesome.
Yeah, there's some really interesting mixes of women and men playing in – early on, it was just by a weird quirk, the sort of group that wound up starting sort of hardcore war gaming tended to be just men. But it was almost a historical accident that was the one group that took off.
Right. Wow. It's so weird because, I mean, and then Tolkien writes.
Well, so this is another part of the story of D&D because you have not just Tolkien, you have a bunch of other fantasy authors that feed into it
Lovecraft
as well. Lovecraft a bit. The Conan series was hugely
Did he have monsters? I only read the comic books.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I recently reread a bunch of the Conan stories a couple of years ago, and they're wonderful. And, he fights a lot of giant apes.
Okay.
There's giant apes.
Who doesn't want to?
Yeah. Usually the giant apes are interested in slave girls. And so he has to rescue the slave girls from the giant apes. That's a common thing.
And then Conan gets to do it with the slave girls, because that was the most porny comic book I think I've ever read in my life.
There are these really great photos of, who's the Howard, the guy who created Conan.
Oh.
Of he and his friends LARPing as barbarians in Texas around the time he was writing Conan. So Conan wasn't just him writing the books. He and his friends would get together in loincloths and run around.
And play Conan.
And play Conan, yes, at the time the Conan books were being written.
Which is like 1908?
Robert Howard. Yeah.
1908?
Yeah, I remember. I think it was later than that. Yeah,
right, but, okay.
Yeah, but it's, and it's like...
Oh, LARPing before LARPing.
Right.
Yeah, just essentially playing Conan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you write Conan,
Conan all you want.
Yeah. Fritz Leiber, who wrote Lankmar, all the Lankmar series.
I never read those.
Oh, Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser.
Okay.
They also had they're very influential with Dungeons and Dragons.
Okay.
And so part of this book is talking about how these various threads of fantasy sort of came together.
Yeah.
To form what sort of being the canonical fantasy of D&D.
Okay. Yeah, well, it's crazy. I mean, like, was Gary Gygax, did he study classics as well? I mean, one would imagine, because all of the Pegasus and the great Medusa.
They would cast out anywhere for monsters. There's this wonderful thing they discovered. A whole set of monsters exist because they found a bag of cheap Japanese plastic toys.
Yeah.
And they were like these little monsters. I'm like, oh, we can use these as miniature figures. So, for example, the owlbear.
Gurhu.
Yeah, the owlbear only exists because there was a little Japanese toy that looked like an owl and a bear. And they're like, oh, what's this? Oh, I guess it's an owlbear. So, yeah. The rust monster also comes from the same bag as plastic.
I don't know the rust. I know the owlbear because I fought an owlbear early on.
Oh, the rust monster is a pure way to fuck with your players because it dissolves their armor.
Oh, it's a monster that creates rust and then dissolves their armor.
Yeah.
And what does it look like?
It looks like this little spidery thing with a propeller for a tail.
Okay.
It looks like a cheap plastic Japanese toy.
They're like, well, what does that toy do? And so then they created a rust monster out of it. Okay. Yeah, because the art is always so interesting. Like, I have a couple of friends who only play 2.0.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why they play.
That's a little too new for me.
Is it just advanced?
I like white box, but
I only know that word. I don't even know what that is. Is that the original?
So the original was brown box, but brown box hardly anybody has. But white box was the first mass release.
Okay.
Before there was AD&D, there was white box.
Okay, and so brown box was just
it was the same thing, but it was in a brown box.
Oh, it was in a brown box.
Yeah, but they only printed like 200 of them or something.
And okay.
Yeah,
that's hilarious.
Yeah.
And then white box did it come in a white box?
It came in a white box.
Oddly enough.
Yeah.
Excellent. And were there mods or what was it?
There were supplements.
Okay.
So you had the first three books, Men and Magic, Monsters and Treasure, and the Underworld and Wilderness Adventures. And then you had the supplements, which were Greyhawk, Blackmoor, Eldritch Wizardry, and Gods, Demigods, and Heroes.
Now, were the supplements worlds, or were they like sort of like a monster manual, or all of it?
It was more just new rules they came up with.
Okay. Oh, expansion sets.
It was more just... that suggests that they were more structured than that. It was more like... We just thought of some new rules here.
That's awesome.
Well, one really interesting thing that ties in with Los Angeles, there in Santa Monica here, there's Arrow Hobbies.
Okay.
And Arrow Hobbies invented the thief class for Dungeons & Dragons. So the original D&D came out.
Okay.
And people were playing it. And everybody's like, hey, we can come up with our own character classes. And so the group playing at Arrow Hobbies, where my son still plays D&D. He goes there every Wednesday night.
Wednesday nights. They got D&D at Arrow Hobbies.
They do. And apparently it's a great campaign.
All right.
But they were like, hey, let's create our own class. Let's create a thief. And they have the correspondence between the guy who owned Arrow Hobbies and Gary Gygax, where he's like, hey, we've been doing this cool thing. And Gygax is like, yeah, that sounds great. And a little later, there's more correspondence saying, hey, you ripped us off. That was our idea.
Yeah.
You just published it. So,
well, So be it. And everybody, it had to be hive mind. I mean, all of this stuff that came together.
Yeah, one of the things that's so great about this is that it was really just all these. Nobody was trying to make D&D. Okay. It was a bunch of people each trying to do their own cool little thing off by themselves.
Right.
And then somebody would be like, oh yeah, that sounds really cool. And they'd pick it up and they'd change it a little.
Yeah.
And somebody else would change it a little. It's really, there was no overarching like desire to produce something.
Yeah.
It was very, very random and it was all labor of love and very, very geeky labor of love.
Super geeky and created not whole cloth. It was just essentially just added onto.
Yeah. So Gygax is famous because he was this real cheerleader for it. He would take ideas that other people had and package them. He was good at aggregating things and mm-hmm. at being
sort of streamlining and making it easy to understand, or no?
More just aggregating. But
I don't think I know what that word means in this.
It means like here's an idea, we can work it into the overall system.
Okay.
But actually turning it into something streamlined, that would come later.
Okay.
But he was also really prolific. So he write tons of articles. He was this huge cheerleader for it. And so that combination of being able to draw together what this community had been doing and promoting it at the same time.
And promoting it by hand. I mean, right? Like every magazine.
By mimeograph machine.
right.
Yeah, it's like,
he's just flyering people.
Yeah.
And in the middle of Gary Gygax is from Wisconsin, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, Lake Geneva.
That's where people from Chicago bury their dead.
Why?
The bad guys. Something I
they
learned.
They dumped them in Lake Geneva?
They dumped them in the cranberry bogs next to Lake Geneva.
That's fascinating.
Yes. I was raised adjacent to dirtbags. So I know, I guess I get the numbers game, and I also get where the dirtbags are buried. Because I'm from Wisconsin, but the... Where does the book go? Where does it end? Does it bring it up to current?
Or? No. It ends with the initial release of D&D.
Oh, fair enough.
Which is
600 pages.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I was reading, I would shout out anecdotes to my wife, and she would keep laughing. But I actually wrote the author a really geeky fan letter because over a footnote.
Right.
He had this really beautiful footnote dating because it's all original sources. He's all gone back and gotten all people's correspondence and notebooks and stuff. And he had a character sheet from the mid-70s. And he spent half a page explaining exactly what month that character sheet must have been created, because the whole system was in flux at the time. And he could say, like, well, they're not referring to hit points. They're referring to health. So that we know that it can't be any later than this because it would have had
carbon
HP.
Carbon dating this character sheet?
Yeah.
Just
and I was just in heaven because...
because that is one of the things that you really do love, the minutiae of the gaming system.
Yeah. I love the...
You love all of it, but
yeah, I love rules, and I love the way people play with rules, and I love the way that people invent rules, and particularly when it's the design is kind of marginal, you know, where it's kind of on the edge of when people are sort of like steering themselves by gut. And,
oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, sort of. It's sort of a big picture, and there's not a narrow canal of how to play a game.
No. Part of what I like is that with D&D. Particularly the really early versions of D&D, you can really see through the rules to the people behind the rules. You can feel the hand of the designer in
the
rules.
Can you feel their personality?
Yeah. You can kind of feel the person behind, like what they were obsessed with and what they were excited about
example?
Oh, well, I mentioned the pole arms. You know,
right.
Yeah. What they're excited about and what is invisible to them, so that they needed to
there was something that I was talking with Andy about where the people's shoes wear out, and if you don't have enough rope, you can't do that. And it's his least favorite way to play those games is because he doesn't want to have to keep track of how many steps the character has taken.
Right.
So that he has to go buy new shoes. And I forget what
he... But the fact that some people love that.
But some people love that. They genuinely, they're just like, no, I want to know. Like, I'm going to get hungry. You know? Like, there was a video game I played on a Mac Classic. And I've talked about it before on this program. And it is called Dungeons of Doom. And Dungeons of Doom was a top-down dungeon crawl with scrolling words on the right-hand side. And I've never been able to find one of those. You know how, like, you can go on the internet and find a something that's been adapted from the Mac Classic that I could now play on
right,
my...
Right, an emulator.
An emulator, yeah. I've never been able to... I've found screenshots, but no emulator.
Right.
And, but it's... There are 40 levels, and you die. You die of starvation. Remember, there was a Lord of the Rings text game where you had to find your way through... the first set of woods, which I forget the name of offhand.
Not Mirkwood. Oh, Mirkwood.
It wasn't Mirkwood? When they go through the...
Oh, one where Old Man Willow is?
Yep.
I think it's just called the Old Forest.
I think you're right. And I died there every single time, and yet I kept going...
Of dysentery, probably.
Of dysentery, and Tom Bombadil not showing up, asshats. I'm like, hey, doesn't Tom Bombadil show up at some point and save me? And he does not. I just get trapped by Old Man Willow and then I die every single freaking time. Very irritating. Get lost in the woods, turned around. But let's talk now about the aesthetic of play, which is the name of your book. Brian Upton, by the way, that's who I'm talking with, at BB Upton. And, it just came out in April, the book. And, see, the aesthetic of play, you were talking at lunch about your favorite parts, like what at GDC, a game developer conference, you did a speech.
Yeah, I just did a talk at GDC. It's easier for me to sort of describe the structure of the book and explain how that talk fits into it.
Right.
It's a book about game design, but it's about how – it's more a book about play design. It's and about how play functions and how play fits into larger cultural – movements.
Oh, okay.
And so the first part is very game designy in that I talk about if you want to design play spaces, what are the characteristics for designing play spaces? And I have what I said of heuristics for structuring situations to make them playful.
Okay.
And it's very high level stuff, sort of like you have to have choice, but those choices have to change over time and those choices have to produce consequences. They're very specific, sort of what I call the rules for rules,
right,
that characterize all play spaces.
Yeah.
But then I take a step back and I say, okay, let's say that this is how play is constituted. Why is this the case? And so then I look at philosophy and neuroscience and semiotics to talk about why should play take this particular form? Why is play a byproduct of the way we as human beings exist within the world? And so
it's, what are semiotics? Just quickly define that.
Semiotics is the study of meaning.
Okay.
And it grows out of linguistics, but it's about why do things mean what they mean and how do they go about meaning.
Okay. So it's game design, but it's also – and you say – and how it affects the culture. So you take a step back from a basic way of creating a game.
Well, it's basically – I create a model for understanding play and then justify why that should be the case. So for example
– Yeah.
please. There's a
– Please example.
Yeah. Okay. This is going to get kind of – I'll try to keep
might
it.
Might it get a little dorky? Go for it.
It may get a little dorky.
Because someone out there is going, thank God someone is finally discussing this.
So I talk about epistemology, which is philosophical theories of knowledge.
That's right.
And
I do know this, but I can't remember offhand.
And part of what I talk about is there an epistemology, a way of thinking about knowledge that in which play makes sense? Because, for example, if you're – it's like why should we want to play from an evolutionary perspective? It's like it doesn't seem to benefit us in any way. And some people have said, oh, well, play is all about learning. But if you really look at how people play, sometimes we learn when we're playing and sometimes we don't. It's not just a learning-related thing.
Okay.
And so there's a branch of epistemology called pragmatism, which was invented in the 19th century by a crazy guy named Charles Sanders Peirce, but has been then developed over time.
Right.
And it basically talks about knowledge only making sense in how we use it to understand the world. So,
well, he sounds like a pile of fun.
he was had the misfortune to not have enough people to talk to. I think the internet would have solved all his issues. So he
because you're never alone. He would not have been alone.
He came up with a lot of stuff when he was alone. And in any case, instead of thinking of knowledge as being knowing the properties of something, pragmatism says it's just about knowing how things behave. So okay. It's not knowing what things are, it's knowing what things do.
Okay.
And this ties in very well with science, because with science, in many
cases...
You have
to figure out.
Right. And with science is all about figuring out what things do.
Right.
And even when you get down to things like subatomic particles, you know, it's like, what is an atom? Do atoms even exist? You have particle wave duality. Are they really there?
Right. It's
does
not
it
the
really...
philosophy of what.
Right. It's the philosophy of how it functions. And so pragmatism feeds into this. And so if you think about this way of understanding knowledge, then there's a procedure that we go through to understand the world that maps on very nicely to how play unfolds. And so we have this...
Somebody's backing up in our neighborhood. I don't know that they can hear it, but that's fine.
Okay.
Eventually they'll stop backing up.
So basically what I do is look at if we have a pragmatic knowledge, a pragmatic model of knowledge production where we are understanding things as they unfold through a system of rules,
right,
then we might enjoy being put in situations where we can anticipate how things would unfold easily. And play spaces tend to be situations.
So it's about control. It's about an illusion of control in our lives.
It is. Because, we want to be in situations where not only do things go the way we want, but we know that they're going to go the way we want.
Right, right.
It's not just we want.
Just soothing.
It's soothing. And it's very relaxing. The analogy I use is like parks are like idealized forms of the African savanna. And it's like if you could live anywhere, you'd want to live in a park because there's lots of nice grass, but there's trees to hide in if the lions come along. And here's fresh water, which means that you're not going to go thirsty. But there's some food nearby probably because there's water.
The popcorn stand.
And so there's something that feels really right about a park as a place to be in an evolutionary sense. It's like that is the idealized physical environment that we want to occupy.
Right, because it's like outdoors, but it's also controlled and you know that it's safe.
Yeah, and so play is the idealized epistemological environment we want to be in.
Right.
It's a situation when we're playing, we're in a situation where the universe makes sense.
Yeah.
Where things happen the way they're supposed to happen.
Right.
But it's not entirely predictable. Something's unexpected happens, but then we figure it out and we love that. It's like so it's all going the way we want, but then we figure it out and then it's going better.
Mm-hmm.
And settling into play is settling into our idealized mental relationship with the world.
Right.
And it's a consequence of the particular ways our brains function. And the way we have to exist within the world as thinking beings.
Right. Okay.
Was that comprehensible?
Totally. I mean, it's. I think it explains to some extent how there's different ways. I mean, there's reasons why we play, and then but that's just part of the. So
part of what I do is I start with games.
Yeah.
With video games, with board games, and say, okay, here are the rules for how games work. These are general rules that apply to all games. And
what are they?
They're basically six heuristics. Choice. You have to be making choices. Variety. These choices can't repeat. You have to be making just different choices over time.
They
change in some way. Consequence. The choices that you make have to affect the choices you can make in the future.
Makes sense.
Predictability. Mm-hmm. You have to be able to anticipate what the consequences will be of what you're doing. But uncertainty. You have to not be able to anticipate perfectly. You have to sometimes be surprised, and so things go the wrong way. And satisfaction, which means you have to be able to win.
Okay.
Or part of what I develop in order to understand this, there's other ways to achieve satisfaction besides winning.
Right.
And,
just some sort of closure.
Yeah. Very good, because that's one of the two other ways to achieve satisfaction.
Sure.
And this actually ties into what we were talking about previously about other ways of playing, the tension between simulation and simulationism and gamism.
Right.
Actually, in experimental role playing circles, they've come up with three. There is gamism, simulationism, and narrativism, and there are different ways of being successful, of being satisfied within a play space. And this is important because in role-playing games, a lot of times you don't win in a role-playing game. You may lose, but how do you lose in a way that feels good? So gamism is playing to win.
Gamism is playing to win, but role-play, when you role-play, are you talking about tabletop role-playing or LARPing or both, or all of it?
Both.
Because if you don't win, but there's still some closure?
Simulation
is to win.
So gamism is playing to win. Simulationism is playing for what I call coherence. And this is a lot of the play of make-believe. Like, I'm going to do these things, and I'm going to try to do them exactly as they should be done, and let's just see what happens.
Okay.
And that feeling of, like,
SCA?
The feeling of being in a role.
Yeah.
This is something that childhood make-believe is all about, is this sort of simulation. It's like, I'm going to hold my role really tightly, and there's a real satisfaction to that.
Yeah.
And then narrativism is playing for closure, playing to either achieve closure or to avoid closure. And so, like, if you're in a LARP and you're in a situation, you often will choose moves that will increase the narrative possibility of what's about to come next. You've done improv, right?
Yes.
And so in improv, like, one of the first rules is, like, you're not supposed to shut down.
Right. You never say no. You say yes and.
Right.
So you agree to whatever they've introduced into the scene, right? I think I'm on a bike. They think I'm a hamster in a wheel. Right. And so they say, why is that hamster so large or whatever? And then you have to go, well, I'm a giant hamster. But then you have to add to it, right? In improv. Is that true?
Yes. And that's because saying no is a closure move. You're shutting it down.
Yeah.
And so you're trying to find a way to move things and open them up and not shut them down.
So narrative play.
Narrative play is all that. But at the end, when you get to the end, you want to wrap things up.
Yeah.
And then so there's got to be a way in the scene. You don't just sort of leave it open-ended. You're like, well, and then we all, you know, let's all get a beer.
Right.
Or one of my favorite things I discovered writing this is that, and they lived happily ever after. Oh, it's such an easy way to get to closure.
Yes.
It's like,
and we're done.
It's all over.
Who wanted donar kebab? Right. Let's get out of here. Right. So is the closure, is that the thing that Andy talks about with the denouement at the end of the game?
Well, I don't know exactly what Andy's talking about. I haven't heard Andy's discussion.
You didn't
discussion.
Hear Andy's speech denouement. At the thing either? Because I thought he did a speech
at GDC.
At GDC.
No, I missed it. Because
Right, yeah.
But, so,
we could get him. It'll all work out. I think he explained it on a previous episode of The Dork Forest. It's all good, with Ed Barriff.
Yeah.
But
The denouement, so not knowing what Andy says, the denouement is super important because the denouement in stories is where play winds down. So you have this moment of
victory screen.
Right. But you have this sense of, like, say you're playing a video game and the power goes out. So, like, it's over, but it's really, really frustrating because you're still thinking about it. Your mind, still, like, going a mile a minute. You're still playing, but you can't connect to the system. And so denouement in either stories or games is where it's over. It's not going to be, it's already been won or lost. You've already resolved everything in a story, you know, like what the final outcome is. But you got to wind down all that play. You got to, like, tie up all the
epilogue-y
loose ends.
Kind of stuff.
It's like, because your mind, even in, you're playing when you read a story or watch a movie as well, there's an element of anticipatory play that happens as you're leaping ahead from incident to incident, trying to figure out what's going to happen. You need this sort of winding down period where everything gets tied up and resolved so that you can stop playing when the experience is actually over.
Right, so that your mind can stop playing.
Yeah.
That makes – okay. So, and I remembered his example, which was the award ceremony at the end of Star Wars 4.
Yes.
Yeah. So when everybody gets their – awards except for Chewie, and or like at the Indiana Raiders of the Lost Ark when they're standing on the steps,
right?
And we get to see where the Ark of the Covenant ends up, and you're like, oh well, we can take a break now, and then the game can continue at another episode or whatever. But this is a denouement. Okay,
right.
I had to redefine it for myself. So sorry.
Yeah, okay. But it's super important because you've been doing all this anticipatory play.
Mm-hmm.
As you've been working your way through the story, and then you get to the end, and you need that time to the story can't give you closure. You have to construct closure for yourself. And so the denouement is where you're finding all these little, you're doing all these little final moves
right.
to bring yourself to closure as the whole thing shuts down.
Okay.
And so that's a big part of the back half of the book is all about how this all applies to narrative. And
okay.
It's about if we have the rules for play, how can we understand stories as play spaces? And partially this is because I think it's really interesting to think of stories as play spaces, but also because we have a hard time in video games integrating stories with gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's better ways to do it, but in order to do it better, you have to kind of understand how stories themselves are being played with. And
because when you read a story, you're actually playing a game.
Yes.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. Well, and this is one reason cutscenes suck so horribly because.
What's cutscenes?
Oh, cutscene. Well, in a video game, you're playing a game. Oh. It's all great. And then there's a cutscene and you're like, oh, God, can I skip this?
Yeah.
Well, the reason you're wanting to skip it is because it's hard to play two games at once. And if you're already playing one game, then stopping playing that game and switching over and playing the different game.
Which is exactly what Criminal Case is doing to me. Andy. Hated this game for I've been playing it for probably 3 years. It is a hidden object game, which is, as far as I'm concerned, it's just a middle-aged Facebook game. That's what, I want to find hidden objects. I want to stop the voices in my head by finding I'm given a tiny list on the bottom of six objects to find. They give me a scene. I find those hidden objects. Next scene, please. Well, there's an interactive another game in it because Criminal Case is also a murder mystery game.
And you have to switch back and forth between the two.
Right. It has turned out that the murder mystery game is actually better than the hidden object game. So I've become willing to play both because whoever is writing the murder mystery game is out of their minds. It is one of the most sexually and racially inappropriate it has to be written by six 23-year-old French dudes in Paris. Andy hated it. He hated it. And then I was explaining to him the Criminal Case parts of the game. And he was like, what the hell are they writing? And then he came over and he was reading along with me. And he's like, this is fascinating because these young programmer guys, right?
Right.
Are programmers, but they're also super emo guys. So they want and it's all supposed to take place in this fictional United States where.
Oh, but they're not American.
No, so they're
French. It's their imaginary United States.
Yeah, imagine that. It is, there was a Native American scene that was like half the noble savage and half the dirtbag. Like they've been clearly watching too much SVU and James Fenimore Cooper. I mean, it's just like a mashup. I'm like, who are you guys?
Natty Bumpo.
It's the craziest thing in the world with shamans and new age bullshit. There's like, it's like Kabbalah meets, it's like the craziest thing in the world. But it is two games at once. It's two games at once.
And so when you have to make that switch, how does it feel?
At first it was crazy, but now I'm like, because I still want to play the hidden object game.
Right.
I'm like, well, I would like to play the hidden object game. But I would also like to find out who did the murder.
Yeah.
And so they got me. They nailed it.
But by accident.
It feels like they did it by accident.
Well, it's just being aware. It's like if you had a game where you had two different modes where you're like, oh, you have the strategic mode and then you have the action mode. The designers would realize that there's a switch that's happening there. You know, that there's, you have to finesse the transition between those two.
Right. Which I don't think that they realized until they were well into that game that there were two.
Probably.
Yeah.
But with story in games, people kind of assume that you can just like turn story on and off. Like you're playing the game and now there's some story and you get some story and then it stops. But realizing the way that you have to spin story up in your mind and then you have to spin it back down again when you move away from it.
Right.
And how that has to kind of interweave with the spinning up and spinning down of the gameplay portion.
Right.
That's tricky. And we haven't had the theory to be able to talk about why that's tricky or how that can go wrong.
I think they did it by accident because here's the thing. I finished the first game. They're the town, Grimsboro, right? 56 levels and the first 30 levels are mostly just hidden object and crime and you're done. But
right.
The last.
Oh, then the story comes in.
Then the story starts to really ramp up. And all of a sudden in Grimsboro, there is an Illuminati and there is some huge giant. And then there is a victory screen where there is, you finally catch the head of the Illuminati and you're like, and you figure out who the genuine bad guys are. And this has been dated back to the Pilgrim days. And so they have these flashback scenes where you have to find victims and find bullshit. And it's like victim's body sitting next to the stockade. And you're like, what? But it was incredibly satisfying that, mm-hmm. first of all, I love a game that ends. It can start up again. But if it has a victory screen and it has a closure, that...
Oh, you gamist.
I'm very much a gamist, but it's also a narrative thing because it had an end. And then they're like, oh, by the way, you're going to take this plane over to the new Pacific Heights where you get a new partner and you get new crimes. Yeah. And I've given them, by the way, dime none. Not a penny.
Good for you.
I would love to give them. I wish I there's part of me that's like, there were games that I bought back in the 80s and 90s that were $65 that changed my life. And I was like, can I give somebody $65 because I've been playing this game for 3 years?
Yeah, I had to design a free-to-play game last year. And
now, tell people, you work at Sony PlayStation.
I work at Sony PlayStation. I'm a senior game designer.
Always have.
For the last...
That's where Andy...
13 years. I've
right. And you worked with Andy and without Andy or whatever. I mean, but the thing is you stayed at Sony PlayStation.
Yeah.
And it's awesome. So, and someone's going to want the only, like, the cool games. Tell the people, like, it does... I don't even care if you just worked on the cameras. Just tell them the famous games that you worked on.
Oh, well, so... What I'm most famous for is what I did before I got to Sony PlayStation. I did the original Rainbow Six and the original Ghost Recon.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
And that was for what company?
That was for Red Storm Entertainment back in North Carolina. And then I moved out here to LA and started working for PlayStation. And my job at PlayStation, I say I don't make games. I make games better.
Okay.
So I don't tend to design games from scratch anymore. What I do is I'm like a script doctor for games. So I'm attached to like three or four projects at a time, and I'll give them critique and feedback and fix things if they get bad.
Like troubleshooting kind of stuff.
And I like to say that the more involved I am with your game, the worse you should feel.
Right.
Because if everything's going great, then I check in with you once a week and I'm like, hey, this is wonderful. And if things are not, then I'm involved more.
Then you have to get more involved. Yeah, yeah. Fair enough. It's Andy says that because he's doing contract stuff now, right? And he said, I'm essentially hired when whoever is producing this game has dropped the ball.
Right.
And they're like, oh, we're not going to be able to make this deadline, so we need more people and at sort of this troubleshooting thing he's doing.
Yeah, and it's fun but it's really stressful. I mean, it's a little like, you know, having the box of parts to create an air filtration system in Apollo 13. It's like, okay, make something out of this. but what I realized is that I oscillated my job between feeling completely worthless when things are going with, wow, like, why am I even here, to feeling completely on the spot when things go wrong. And so it's like I can never find this happy medium where I'm just like contributing just enough. I'm like, oh, either you don't need me or God, oh, how are we ever going to solve this?
Right. So what we're almost at an hour. So we should talk about for sure. I should tell people Brian Upton, and then on Twitter it's at BB Upton. Mm-hmm. And is there and everyone should just go get it. This has been a fascinating conversation. And the aesthetic of play is on Amazon, right?
Yeah, it's from MIT Press.
MIT
Press. It's on Amazon.
You wanted to tell the story. Because I wanted you to tell the story of why MIT Press.
Oh, it was. There's several reasons why MIT Press. First, MIT rejected me for both undergrad and grad school, so this is a little bit of
finally.
But
we're
also,
still going to be friends.
But also, it's because my wife is a professor at UCLA, and a lot of what's in the aesthetic of play came out of conversations that we had about general art and aesthetics and culture, and we wanted to build on it. She and I are now collaborating on another book that ties in with her stuff. She's a music historian, and
I've been trying to get her on the show forever. I got to get her on.
I texted her right before we started saying she should come on. But we're talking about the ways in which the presentation of music can be interpreted through as play spaces, and a lot of the actual heavy lifting is hers. She's doing a lot of the theoretical work for this book, and I'm sort of like chiming in with my play stuff. And
well, I think you're answering the academic questions that she comes up with, right?
Yes.
To some extent?
And so part of the reason that I wanted to publish this with an academic press is because I wanted it to lead into game studies and literature and music theory. I wanted it to go broad within a broader intellectual community, not just be, hey, here's a cool way to make games, even though it is helpful for making games, I think. but I wanted it to
be
accessible.
But it's also got theoretical.
It has a lot
study.
Of theoretical stuff that ties in with what people are trying to do in other parts of the humanities.
That's awesome. That's it's. I mean, there are so many. I mean, there's ways to study. Like, you didn't get into game design by getting a BA in game design.
Oh, I don't think they existed.
Right. I don't think they did either. I think it's relatively new, right?
I got into game design by virtue of the fact that my family wouldn't play games with me. So I had to just sit around and play by myself.
And then you were like, isn't there a job? Like, how did you get your first job in gaming? I'm sure everyone's asked that, but allow me to be the one as well.
Well, so I had given up thinking about the games as a career. I was actually a computer graphics guy, and I'd been doing graphics in the 90s.
What program were you using?
I was writing the programs. I was a programmer. I was working for a company that was doing what Photoshop did before Photoshop existed.
Okay.
And then Photoshop came along and put us out of business because they didn't need us in our little specialty boutique thing anymore. Mm-hmm. And so then I went back to graduate school to get a master's, and I happened to have as my faculty advisor Fred Brooks. I went, ooh, name drop, the Mythical Man Month guy.
I don't know that guy.
He's kind of a computer science legend.
Okay.
Everybody's
famous to a few people.
Yeah, if people have heard of the Mythical Man Month, that's Fred Brooks. And he was a really sweet guy. And when I say he's my advisor, I meant that, like, I had to report to somebody. I wasn't like his disciple or anything. But I discovered that I was not as good at graduate school as I thought. I'm like, okay, master's, I'm going to get it out. And he happened to be involved with a company in North Carolina called Virtus that was doing 3D tools but wanted to do 3D games.
Okay.
And he's like, hey, I got this guy and he's finishing with his master's. Do you want him as your graphics programmer?
Oh, yeah.
And at first I was like, whoa, you know, I don't know. I kind of wanted to like maybe work for Pixar or something cool like that. Working for like this. And my wife's like, why don't you have all those like board games in the closet you designed? And I'm like, oh, yeah, I did kind of do that as a hobby because I've been doing design as a hobby. I just never thought of it as a career. I was a programmer. And so then
– because it was just a dorkdom.
Right.
It was just something to do.
And so then I started working for this company, and it turned out that all those years of as a hobbyist, I knew more about game design than almost anybody in the company. And so – and then when we wound up starting up Redstorm grew out of that company.
Yeah.
I was the designer on Rainbow Six.
That's fascinating. And that was 15 years ago or something.
That was 16 years ago.
Yeah. So, a long time. Everyone I know who is of an age where there wasn't a way in, right?
Yeah.
You had to, it's stories like that where someone's like, well, we need someone who knows how to make a game, and this guy's just been making them in his closet for the last 12 years.
Yeah. Well, when I went to write the book, I actually mentioned this in the intro to the book. It's like, much of my interaction with games wasn't even playing games. It was sitting down by myself with games and reading rules.
Right.
And so still, I really love this.
That is serious dorkdom right there. Like, that is like, the way.
One of my best ways to enjoy a new game is to like a board game is like you buy a new board game and you open the box and you sit there and smell it and you read the rules. And there's plenty of games where that's the only way I've experienced them is reading the rules. But that way of that particular dorkiness that I started doing when I was like 12, 13, that kind of became the model for my career. And so
there is a certain amount of fun in the unboxing and the reading of the rules. It reminds me of the people that I played Dungeons and Dragons with who are friends of Andy's that have been for a gajillion years. They, as a hobby, as just a thing, they get the new D&D book and read it, like nighttime reading. All they're doing is reading how stats are organized and how, what different monsters have capabilities of. And they're looking at charts and graphs. And I'm like, well, thank God I don't have to, because it's not my thing. I want to play.
But understanding why that's fun.
Yeah.
That's what my book's about.
Okay.
That sort of anticipatory play. That's sort of like when you're not actually interacting. When you're just in these, what I call moments of stillness, or the play of stillness, that was my talk at GDC.
Yeah.
When you're in these moments of stillness, what are you doing mentally?
Yeah.
And why do some moments of stillness feel playful and other moments of stillness not? That's right at the heart of the work that I'm doing.
Brian Upton, nice work, man. This has been fascinating. I have learned about how D&D came to be, and then I learned way too much about the whole aesthetic of play. People, get out there. If you were fascinated like I am, and you think that you'd enjoy the book, it's called The Aesthetic of Play, written by Brian Upton, MIT Press. And you're doing vital work out there by listening to The Dork Forest and no doubt being nice to each other. So I'll talk to you later. Bye.
My hat, my hat, my hat. They're dancing around my hat, my hat, my hat, my hat. Well, what do you think of that? If it looks like a Mexican hat dance and it sounds like a Mexican hat dance, it's most likely a Mexican hat dance. So take off your hat and let's dance.
Yay! Oh, my God. Why don't we just call that as the end of the show?